Thank you. Marshall, if you could open court, please.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Reyes, Judge Eade, the Honorable Peter M. Reyes presiding.
Thank you. Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Friday, April 12th, 2024. We have one calendar on our, I'm sorry, we have one case on our calendar today. That is A23-0545, Alexander John Cookston, appellant versus State of Minnesota, respondent. This matter has been rescheduled. It was originally scheduled for January, and we are now hearing oral arguments today. Judge Elise Larson is not available for this particular argument, but she will be, this will be recorded, and she will be listening to it, and we will be conferencing after listening to oral arguments for this morning. For each party, you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, followed by 5 minutes for rebuttal by appellant's attorney, if you so choose. We do have a timer there. Please note that the time there, so you can keep track of how much time that you have left. This is being recorded and live streamed. However, no other recordings are permitted without permission from the court. But you will have access to the recording shortly after our oral arguments today. So, with that, counsel for appellant, please state your name for the record and the party you are representing, and you may begin.
Good morning. My name is Amber Johnson. I represent Alexander Cookson, the appellant in this matter. There are two issues before the court. First is whether the district court abused its discretion in finding that appellant's claims of ineffective assistance of trial counsel was procedurally barred by NAFLA. And second is whether or not the district court erred in finding that appellant did not make a sufficient showing of ineffective assistance of counsel at his appellate counsel. I'd like to start with the NAFLA bar. In this case, there was a hearing where testimony was taken, and that testimony was provided by both the trial attorney, the appellate attorney, and Mr. Cookson. And Mr. Cookson did provide information as to conversations between he and his trial attorney. Additionally, his trial attorney was asked questions about her why things happened the way they did and whether or not she could remember what she was talking about with Mr. Cookson before he decided whether or not he was going to testify. And so the ineffective assistance of counsel claim runs not only through the trial, but also the discussions that were had between Mr. Cookson and his trial attorney that were off the record.
But
So,
you agree, counsel, that the evidentiary hearing didn't add anything to the ineffective assistance of counsel Rule 412 claim, right? I mean, the trial counsel essentially just testified as to not being able to recall what essentially was the reasoning and the grounds for the 412 motion, and so, or the 412 issue. And so really nothing more came out of the evidentiary hearing than was available on direct appeal. Do you agree with that?
I agree that there was no additional information garnered from the trial attorney, but the fact that she did testify that she couldn't recall, I don't think that that informs whether or not there should have been an evidentiary hearing and whether or not this should be
There was an
procedurally.
evidentiary hearing. This wasn't a summary denial, right? So, I mean, the issue is whether or not what was adduced at the evidentiary hearing would have aided in any analysis of the issue on direct appeal, right? For purposes of the NAFLA bar. Am I right? Do you
Correct.
agree with that?
Yes, and our position is that the district court should have taken into consideration the information that was provided during the evidentiary hearing, especially the information provided by Mr. Cookson, the appellant, and have actually analyzed whether or not there was an ineffective assistance of counsel claim that was meritorious, and that the court didn't do that. and
Right. So
sort of.
I just wanted to, I mean, don't you think your stronger argument is as to the failure to advise, because more information came out about that at the evidentiary hearing. And I also know you cited some supplemental authority yesterday on that issue.
Yes.
So I'm wondering if you could address specifically why. And just to confirm what my understanding is, the failure to advise was on the ability of Mr. Cookson to testify about the victim's drug use prior, not about the not about consent or anything like that, not about prior sexual relationship. It was the failure to appropriately advise about his ability to testify to the drug use. Am I right about that?
Yes, but there is more to, at least the way that I interpret Mr. Cookson's testimony to be. I think there's more to that because he says in his testimony that he didn't think he could even testify that they were in a relationship. And he thinks that because of what he was told by his trial counsel, he believed that anything he wanted to say, because they were directly linked to either drug usage in the past or drug or their sexual relationship, that because it was maybe not directly on point, but it came from that area, that he wouldn't be able to testify about that either. I
But
think so.
it wasn't about the phone calls, right? The calls in which he was encouraging the victim to not pursue the matter, or the discussions with the sister, or anything like that, right? That wasn't the advice from counsel, that he wouldn't be able to testify about that.
I would agree when it's coming to that specific phone call, that would not have fallen under any of those, the information that he received from his trial attorney, that he would basically be unable to testify about that and be objected to immediately.
So
And
here's why I'm asking these questions, and then I'll let you continue. And I think Judge Reyes might have a question, but your supplemental authority that you brought to the court's attention yesterday has to do with the Howell Willer case. And in that case, the trial counsel never informed the defendant that he would not have a self-defense defense if he didn't testify. And the trial court had told trial counsel, if your client doesn't testify and meet his burden there, I'm not going to give a self-defense instruction. And in fact, indicated the trial court, and as the trial court did, would give a non-self-defense instruction, that there's no self-defense. So in Mr. Cookson's case, the even if we presume that this isn't a situation and there's no bar, this isn't an as a matter of law structural error for preventing Mr. Cookson from testifying, but it's an inadequate advice or incorrect advice case. Isn't the difference between Howeiler in this case that he was still able to pursue his defense, that this never happened? There was nothing about his decision not to testify that prevented him from pursuing the same defense that he ultimately did. It was just that he didn't get up and talk about the drug use or the past relationship. And he was never affirmatively misadvised, even about the jail call. So isn't that an important distinction between this case and Howeiler or Howeiler?
I don't think that it is necessarily, because the way Mr. Cookson testified at the evidentiary hearing, it was that he couldn't tell any of his story because everything was so intertwined with drug usage and their past sexual relationship that he was prevented from being able to explain what was happening on the jail call with the accuser, that he wasn't able to explain what happened with the jacket, and he wasn't able to explain what was going on between the two of them.
But the prior sexual, that's the other thing, right? Is the trial prior sexual conduct, that's the 412 evidence, and that was accurate advice from trial counsel, because the district court had said you can't testify about that.
Right.
And so the only incorrect thing was the drug use, right? I mean, that's the only incorrect advice.
Yes. According to the rulings that were made by the trial court, but the drug use of that day Mr. Cookson believed could explain why she might have fabricated what the actual argument was about, and be able to explain basically what happened that day. And he didn't believe that he was able to say that she had been using drugs that day.
Well, right. I mean, the district court ruled that he could not talk about any prior drug use, but he could talk about any drug use that she engaged in that day to explain what was going on and why she reacted the way she did. He was not precluded from doing that, correct?
Correct, he was not, but that was not the advice that he got from counsel, according to his testimony.
Right, but at the same time, trial counsel testified to not having much knowledge, recollection, I should say, of what advice was given, but that the transcripts would be accurate as to what had been discussed and what had been communicated, and that she would have communicated that information to him.
She does, but she doesn't recall specifically doing any of that to
Right.
with
So
Mr. Cookson.
how does that post-conviction testimony provide any new evidence? And it seems like, in fact, it's lacking any new evidence to meet any exception to the NAFLA bar.
Well, the trial record supports Mr. Cookson's testimony in that the trial attorney did not cross-examine the accuser about her drug usage on the day of the alleged or the incident. And so in doing that, it supports Mr. Cookson's assertion that he was told he can't talk about drugs at all, period.
Well,
And
but isn't that really trial strategy as to what questions to ask and not to ask? We don't typically review trial strategy. That sounds like pure trial strategy there.
it isn't trial stat strategy if that information was given to Mr. Cookson when he was determining whether or not to testify, and that information was incorrect.
What was incorrect about the information?
Mr. Cookson testified at the evidentiary hearing that he believed that he was not able to talk about drug usage at all, not just like past drug usage, but the drug usage the day of.
But what testimony from trial counsel supports that as well? That's only testimony from Mr. Crookston. And the post-conviction court can determine whether or not that testimony is credible or not, or if there's anything else in the record to support that. Is there anything from trial counsel's testimony at the post-conviction hearing that supports that testimony by Mr. Crookston?
There isn't, but there also wasn't a credibility determination made by the district court as to Mr. Cookson's testimony because
Well,
it.
I certainly agree there isn't an explicit one, but there certainly can be an implicit one as to whether or based on what the ultimate decision was by the post-conviction court.
Yes, that, but that we do not know if that was taken in, if Mr. Cookson's credibility was taken into consideration by the district court because they did not specifically address it at all in the order.
There's nothing apparent in the trial record, for purposes of the direct appeal that really addresses this adequate advice issue, right? I mean, that's why your argument is there's a, or at least it seems like you have a stronger argument as to the NAFLA bar not applying to the improper or inaccurate advice IAC claim, correct?
Correct. And
Because, okay, go ahead.
well, and part of, we do argue that because there is a record, the appellate court could determine this case on the merits, but it would also be appropriate to remand it back to the district court to have the district court specifically go through the process with the facts that were also or were added to this argument and issue in the evidentiary hearing with the testimony of the attorneys and Mr. Cookson, and run through the analysis and make a determination according to law in that respect.
But I just want to ask, if if you we do think the record is adequate, you agree that we're going to engage in a harmless error analysis of this issue, right? I mean, the question is on the, well, particularly as to prejudice, if we go through Strickland, Mr. Cookston made a decision not to testify, and say we agree with you that that advice was inaccurate as to the drug use issue on the day of. He made a decision to testify based on arguably that inadequate or inaccurate advice, plus accurate advice about prior sexual relationship. And really, there's nothing in the record to indicate he was told he can't testify about the phone calls from the trial attorney. So it was his decision to say it's too intertwined. I'm going to decide not to testify. And so at the end of the day, we can look at the fact that there are these phone calls in the record that are really strong evidence of his guilt, and decide whether or not his decision, looking at perhaps arguably the inaccurate advice on drug use, actually resulted in any, or the advice he received resulted in any prejudice, right? You agree that would be the appropriate way to frame our analysis?
I know that that is how case law is presented, but I would argue that this is a constitutional right, and whether or not it's not,
But it's a constitutional right if the attorney coerced him, right? This isn't that case. And Hauweiler and the subsequent
right.
cases draws that distinction. And the attorney didn't say you can't testify, or you didn't do anything to deprive him of that right. This is an inaccurate advice claim. Am I right about that?
You are, and may I'm out of time. May I answer your question?
Yes, you may.
The argument that I am making is that the end result is the same, which is that he did not exercise his constitutional right, whether that was by force or by being given inaccurate information, the end result's the same. And although that there is the strain of cases about prejudice, that it's essentially inappropriate because whether someone says you can't testify or gives you information that leads you to the belief that you sh basically can't testify, it's the same thing and it's the same right that's being violated. And therefore, it should require just a reversal and a new trial, just like it would if someone had affirmatively or coercively or physically stopped someone from testifying.
I do have one final question. I realize you're out of time, but because I'm presiding, I have the ability to do that. You talk about there being a strain of cases, but isn't that the case law that we follow? Is it Strickland in terms of when a claim is brought of ineffective assistance of counsel, which requires the two prongs, including the second prejudice prong?
Right, but I, when it comes to the right to testify and whether or not that's prevented, it wouldn't fall under Strickland, is what I'm saying. It would
Okay.
fall under the Rosillo cases. Thank
Okay.
you.
Thank you, counsel. And you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel
Thank
for
you.
respondent, you will have 15 minutes for your argument, followed by rebuttal by appellant.
Thank you. My name is Pamela Foss, and I represent this respondent in this case, the state of Minnesota and Clay County. I don't have a lot to add other than what was in my brief. I do agree with Judge I that the record is pretty clear and nothing was added at the evidentiary hearing regarding the NAFLA bar. The attorney Ruth Lee, who was the trial attorney, testified that she'd been an attorney for many years. She's been a defense counsel. I think she's the head of the public defenders in her area. She's tried many cases. She didn't remember the conversations that she had off the record with her client. She re referred repeatedly back to the transcript. Transcript was clear what the judge had ordered. Mr. Cookson was present in the courtroom when those rulings were made. And I do think, although it wasn't explicitly written in the order by the judge at the district court level, that the credibility of Mr. Cookson was probably less than stellar, that it's implied. The record didn't reflect what Mr. Cookson was saying. The testimony provided at the hearing didn't add anything, and therefore this was
I'm sorry, Ms. Voss, but isn't that the distinction between the two claims, I think, is important, right? I mean, with regard to 412, I see your NAFLA bar argument. I understand that. But to me, if you look at the evidentiary hearing and what came out of the evidentiary hearing, there is actually some valuable evidence that wasn't apparent from the trial transcript and the record about the advice between trial counsel and Mr. Cookson. So Mr. Cookson, so why does NAFLA bar the improper advice claim when that information wasn't apparent from the trial record?
I think that it was, well, there was the trial record, but also the only thing that was added was Mr. Cookson and what he testified to. He had the opportunity at the appellate, his first appeal, his direct appeal that went through, to tell that appellate attorney if he believed that he had been misadvised, that there was some inadequacy of counsel. He didn't do that. That wasn't ever, from what we could tell. Otherwise, it would have been included in the first appeal.
Well, if he had tried to do that, though, wouldn't he have had to move to stay the appeal and then go back to the trial court to have an evidentiary hearing? Because the inherent nature of trial counsel advice about the right to testify, it's never going to be in the trial record, because that's an attorney-client privilege conversation. And that's always essentially, unless there's some, you know, remark that's made unusually on the trial record, it's generally always going to require an evidentiary hearing, a waiver of the attorney-client privilege, and a post-conviction proceeding to flesh that out. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes. And that was available before the first direct appeal was completed.
But we've never held that someone not doing that, not choosing to do that in a direct appeal to stay and go back and have that post-conviction proceeding would foreclose their right to pursue that same claim in a subsequent post-conviction proceeding. Or are you aware of authority that stands for that proposition?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that at the time of the direct appeal, that was an issue that could have been raised. It could have been stay the appeal, file the post-conviction, then they would have had that within the timelines, and they could have addressed that in the first appeal. So they had.
Wouldn't that require us to adopt a rule, though, that says that, you know, even where the trial record itself is inadequate to support that kind of claim of post-conviction relief, the NAFLA bar is always going to apply if a defendant elects to simply pursue the issues that are within the four corners of the trial record on direct appeal, and then later try to pursue post-conviction relief? I mean, wouldn't we be adopting a new rule if we were to take your view of the NAFLA bar as to the inadequate advice claim?
And I think maybe I'm not being completely clear. I'm not saying that he couldn't raise it in the post-conviction relief, but I'm saying it's barred because nothing came out at the evidentiary hearing on his post-conviction relief petition that would add to the claim. Because the court appears from the record and from her order didn't find Mr. Cookson's testimony credible.
And counsel, when you are talking about the claim, are you talking about just specifically the claim regarding the inability to testify with respect to drug use?
No, I'm talking about the misadvice of counsel, why he didn't testify at trial.
Right. But I'm on that issue. I think the key area is whether he could testify about drug use and what advice that he received. He said that he was told by counsel, if I recall the record correctly, that he could not testify about any drug use by the alleged victim here at all. Whereas what the district court actually determined is that he could testify about drug use on the day of the incident. He just couldn't talk about prior drug use.
Right.
And isn't that testimony by appellant at the post-conviction hearing, isn't that corroborated by the fact that his trial counsel never even questioned the victim about her drug use on the day of the incident?
No, I think that goes back to trial strategy. I think it was a strategic move by the defense counsel that she didn't ask her about that. And I don't think there was anything in the record prior to the cross-examination that there was any drug use involved by any party in this matter. So I would think that's a trial strategy, like was pointed out. It's not something that is reviewed in a post-conviction relief or a assist ineffective assistance of counsel claim.
Well, but didn't he make statements right after about the fact that she had been taking drugs that day? Wasn't there some evidence? And if that's the case, why didn't trial counsel, why didn't appellant's trial counsel ask the victim about whether she actually had been taking drugs that day that might have affected her or impaired her judgment?
And I guess I'm a little confused. You said he said that she took drugs that day. Do you mean the defendant?
Correct.
Okay, because he never testified, so that he
Right.
didn't.
No, no,
There
no.
was.
I'm not talking about testing because he didn't testify, but statements that he had made to the police officers.
Right, which hadn't ever come into the trial. So to me, it's a trial strategy, and I don't know, why a defense attorney decides on their trial strategy, but Miss Lee has been an attorney for many, many years. And if that she didn't ask those questions, she had a reason behind it. And I don't know what that trial strategy would be, but to me, that's a trial strategy. If she's listened to the court's ruling and she said during the evidentiary hearing, she testified she doesn't know what her specific advice was, but that she was going to follow the court order.
So, to go back to your questions or your responses earlier, when you're saying that the trial court, and we should find that, I mean, the trial courts, the post-conviction court, I should say, you agree that there's no explicit credibility finding regarding Mr. Cookson's testimony, right?
Yes.
And so what you would argue is what you're arguing is that there's an implicit credibility finding that Mr. Cookson's testimony about what his attorney told him about drug use was not credible. But that's a different ground to affirm than saying that the claim was Nafla barred, right? I mean, that required actually an analysis of the evidence that came out at the hearing, which is distinct about the improper advice claim, and that's distinct from the 412 issue, because the 412 issue, there's really nothing that Mr. Cookson offered at the evidentiary hearing that supplemented the trial record for the court's analysis of that issue. And so that's why it seems like there's a better argument to say the Nafla bar applies to the Rule 412 ineffective assistance of counsel claim. But if we have to rely on an implicit and credibility determination, then aren't you really agreeing that the Nafla bar does not apply to that ineffective assistance claim?
I would say that it seems reasonable that it would. But that wasn't what was really raised or argued to the court. And
Well, I think that is what Ms. Johnson is arguing here, is that the Nafla bar, and that's why she's urged that we consider remanding, to actually get an analysis by the trial court of the merits of the claim. So the reason why I'm asking this is because your brief tended to just focus on the Nafla bar rather than the merits. But it seems like by asking us to s agree that the district court implicitly found Mr. Cookson's testimony not credible for purposes of affirming, we are looking beyond any Nafla bar. We're saying that the merits of the claim were within the district court's discretion to substantively deny. Is that your argument?
well, I think under the NAFLA bar, if it's something that was available at the time of the direct appeal, it's barred. And I think the misadvice was available at the time of his direct appeal.
But there was no evidence in the trial court record at the time of the direct appeal about what advice was given or what wasn't between Mr. Cookson and his trial counsel, right?
Not in the trial record, no, but it could have been developed through a post-conviction relief. They could have stayed the appeal if she got that, if the appellate counsel received that information from Mr. Cookson, because it was known to him at the time of the taking of the appeal. They could have fleshed that out and supplemented.
Right, but aren't you, again, so that brings me back. I mean, aren't you arguing then that we need to adopt a rule that anytime someone files a direct appeal, they need to necessarily stay the appeal in every case, ask for a post-conviction hearing to develop any information like this, that's attorney-client advice. Otherwise, they're going to face a NAFLA bar if they later try to do that. I just don't know. Maybe you're aware of some, but I don't know that there's any authority for us to adopt such a broad rule.
And I don't, I guess I haven't looked at that. I just know that it happens in our here quite a bit that we have appeals filed and they're then stayed. Post convictions are filed and then we address those. So we only have to do one appeal. So
I agree you can do that, but I just don't know that it, just because that is a procedural avenue available, that means that you're going to be NAFLA barred if you don't do that. And it seems like that's what you're arguing with regard to this specific claim. Do I have that wrong?
No, you don't have that wrong. That's yeah.
So counsel, you just have a couple minutes left. I was wondering if you could address the due process clause violation issue with respect to that appellant has raised. Why isn't that applicable here in addition to the ineffective assistance of counsel claim?
Which due process? You mean?
His right to testify.
Oh. Well, Your Honor, I don't think the record reflects his right to testify, that he was prevented from doing that. That was his choice. He was provided, counsel's indicated that during the evidentiary hearing that she would have advised him on his right to testify, that it was completely his choice to testify, whether he wanted to or not, based on what was ordered in the court. And he was present when that was ordered. I don't see anything that in the evidentiary hearing or in the record that would in any way imply that his not testifying had anything to do other than he chose not to. So, and I don't believe that there's anything in the record to show that he was given any misadvice. He was listened to the court. He heard the court's ruling. There was nothing that said that he couldn't discuss drug use that day. He couldn't discuss prior drug use, but not he. There was nothing in the record that indicated he, if he wanted to testify and say that she had used drugs that day, that he couldn't do that. And there was also nothing in the record that would indicate that he wasn't, like the court said, able to, even without his testimony, provide his defense, because his defense was presented to the court whether or not he testified or not. But I just don't think there's anything in the record to show that other than his choice to testify, that he was influenced or coerced or told by his defense counsel that he could not testify. I think at the evidentiary hearing, he even said it was his choice not to testify.
And I don't see any other questions. So thank you very much, counsel.
Yeah, thank counsel, you.
Yes. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Well, you're muted, ma'am.
Thank you. First, I just want to address the prejudice question. My argument would be that a defendant is inherently prejudiced if he is not able to testify or believes he's not able to testify. It is the one opportunity that a defendant has to tell his story,
but
to
counsel,
deny
if I
his
could,
own voice.
Counsel, if I could stop you there, my apologies, but it sounds like you're conflating actually the ineffective assistance of counsel claim with a due process claim of person's right to testify.
I don't think it's a conflation. I think it's a result that the court could find that there is prejudice in not being able to testify, especially in a case where it is he said, she said situation, where the credibility of one witness is going to be determined by the jury and the credibility of the defendant may or may not be determined by the jury, depending on if they testify. And
But
so,
we also have the issue here, and we haven't talked about this yet, that if he did decide to testify and he did, both he and his trial counsel noted that he had been informed in terms of the pluses and minuses of testifying. If he did testify, he would have been impeached with a prior conviction. And so we have to look at whether or not the post-conviction court abuses discretion by determining that he would not have been prejudiced. And that prejudice prong, we look at whether the outcome would have been different, given all the evidence that the victim testified as to exactly what happened and what he forced her to do. We have the recordings, the telephone calls. There's substantial evidence. How would his testimony have changed the outcome?
Well,
And taking into account also, I might add that the district court did put boundaries on even the drug testimony. It would have only been testimony of that day and not of anything prior or subsequent.
correct. And that particular crime was not a like crime for what Mr. Cookson was being charged with in this trial. Additionally, throughout the entire trial, the jury knew that Mr. Cookson was in jail at the time that this happened, that he was on work release. There was already a lot of prejudice against him in that respect. So I don't believe that the impeachment factor of the past criminal conviction necessarily has the same strength as it may sh if someone had not had the jury know that they were on work release and that they were presumably in jail for something that they don't know about. But that was already prejudicial to Mr. Cookson and essentially unavoidable.
Can I just ask you before the time runs out? I just want to jump back to something you had raised at the beginning of your first argument. You had argued that for us to consider this a due process violation, as Judge Reyes was just questioning you, and that you'd say the Rocio line of cases would control. But you cited Howler or Howeiler today, or yesterday, and Howeiler to me it cites Rocio. And it draws a distinction between Rocio and specifically says the claim is not that petitioner's counsel refused the petitioner in that case to permit him to testify, but that his counsel failed to adequately inform him of facts relevant to his decision whether or not to testify. And then the Supreme Court applied the harmless error beyond a reasonable doubt test. And this makes sense because it's a 1980 case. Strickland's not decided until 1984. In just a few months after Howeiler, the State v. Smith, the Supreme Court again says that the petitioner doesn't attempt to recharacterizes it again as not a denial of the right to testify, but rather a failure of trial counsel to adequately inform him of facts relevant to the decision. So, would you agree, based on that reading, that this is what you're raising is not a due process claim? It's not structural error. It's a more traditional Strickland analysis now that we have Strickland since those cases were decided.
I would agree. I still do believe that Mr. Cookson can satisfy the prejudice prong of of the analysis, and that he was prejudiced by not being able to explain his side of the story or to give his testimony as to what happened the day of the alleged incident.
Thank you. And I don't have any other questions, and I don't think Judge Ede has any more questions. Okay.
No,
Thank you.
thank you.
Thank you both counsel for your arguments. We appreciate you taking the time and answering our questions. We will be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory time frame. Thank you both. Take care, and court is adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.